Appeals, in and for the Seventh Judicial Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention, as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is the United States versus Baldwin. Mr. Staunton.
May it please the court, my name is Tom Staunton. I represent Lloyd Baldwin, who is appealing his conviction on four counts of wire fraud and his 78-month sentence. This morning I'd like to discuss three of the issues raised by Mr. Baldwin: the position of trust enhancement, the intent to defraud, and the Booker-Blakeley issue. First, on position of trust, the district court's two-level enhancement for position of trust should be reversed. The district court committed a legal error by interpreting Section 3B1.3 as automatically applying to a person who holds themselves out as an investment broker offering an investment opportunity, and also by failing to address whether Mr. Piscopo, gave Mr. Baldwin the requisite level of discretion. Position of trust does not turn on job titles. It turns on discretion, substantial management professional type discretion, the type of discretion you give an attorney, a bank officer, a physician. The relevant question here is whether Mr. Piscopo gave Mr. Baldwin that level of discretion. He clearly did not. Mr. Piscopo didn't hire Mr. Baldwin to be his money manager. He hired him to carry out a specific investment program. He gave Mr. Baldwin the authority to take a fixed amount of money and place it with certain banks for a fixed period of time with a guaranteed return. Mr. Baldwin had no discretion to vary from this authority. That's illustrated by what happened when Mr. Piscopo suggested a little bit of a different approach to roll over his $1 million. Mr. Baldwin did not have the authority to make that change. Instead, Mr. Piscopo signed a separate written authorization for that transaction. The government in its brief makes various assertions about Mr. Baldwin's actual discretion. What was happening behind the scenes is irrelevant on this point, because what matters, substantial discretion is measured from the point of view of the victim. Yeah, the operative question is whether Mr. Piscopo believed he was giving Mr. Baldwin the requisite discretion. Every fraud involves, to a certain extent.
If a lawyer absconds with funds from a client trust account, is that an abuse of a position of trust?
It depends what the terms of the trust account are. The key
perfectly
here is
normal trust account. You have to put the money in 100% safe interest-bearing deposits, or if it's small, in an interest on lawyer's trust account fund. The lawyer doesn't have any discretion over these accounts except to act as a trustee.
In that situation, if he was giving, the distinction, I guess, is between a bank teller type of thing where you give someone the money and they're not going to hold it for you and you're just asking them to deposit it, and between someone who is actually managing or holding the account. And the evidence here shows that Mr. Baldwin...
I'm not asking about the evidence here. I'm asking about, is the lawyer in a position of trust with respect to a client trust account?
If he has a fiduciary obligation to handle the funds and to take care of the funds, then he is.
The answer is yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Hmm.
Mr. Piscopo simply did not entrust Mr. Baldwin with this level of discretion, the substantial professional management type discretion, the position of trust enhancement.
Look, that's the reason why I asked. The lawyer, with respect to a client trust account, doesn't have management type discretion. He's not a money manager, but he is responsible for doing as required with the funds, which are in his safekeeping. That's why I wanted to pursue that analogy.
But he has a fiduciary relationship, and he has a fiduciary obligation to the client in that situation, and that makes it different from this situation, where it was simply someone offering an investment program and taking a check and putting it into the investment program. Second point I want to talk about this morning is specific intent to defraud. Mr. Baldwin's conviction should be reversed because no rational trier of fact could have found beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Baldwin had a specific intent to defraud Mr. Piscopo. The record contains no direct evidence of a specific intent to defraud. and it contains none of the usual indirect indicators of fraud. And it supports Mr. Baldwin's claim that he was deceived by a more sophisticated person who actually benefited from the scheme. Among other things, the record demonstrates that Mr. Baldwin derived little benefit from the scheme. That Mr. Baldwin and Mr. Piscopo truly were good friends. Mr. Baldwin had no formal education or experience in financial investments. Mr. Reeves and Mr. Horvat were the principal beneficiaries of the scheme. And Mr. Reeves, not Mr. Baldwin, was the mastermind of the scheme and set up the program and provided and signed the contracts governing the program. In light of these facts, no rational trier of fact could have found beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Baldwin had a specific intent to defraud Mr. Piscopo. His conviction should be reversed. The third issue I want to discuss this morning is the Booker-Blakely issue. In this case, many of the facts used to increase Mr. Baldwin's sentence were not charged and were found by the court on a preponderance of the evidence standard. Under Booker and Blakely, that was error, and this court should vacate Mr. Baldwin's sentence and remand for resentencing. The government doesn't really dispute that this is what Booker requires. Instead, the government makes several waiver arguments, but none of the arguments have merit. First, Mr. Baldwin did not waive his Booker rights by consenting to a bench trial. The record reflects that what Mr. Baldwin consented to was a bench trial on guilt or innocence, not sentencing. And that makes sense because Mr. Baldwin
could
not...
I don't understand that. There's no set of cases where you have a bench trial on guilt and then a jury trial on sentence.
It's because a jury trial was not available on sentencing.
Well...
And that's,
if
that
Booker is correct, a jury trial was always available on sentence. It's just that we were mistaken in thinking otherwise.
That gets to my next point, and also it gets
but
to
I,
the...
But I still don't understand why, when one waives a jury trial, one hasn't waived a jury trial. And Blakely said exactly that. If the defendant waives a jury trial, then obviously he doesn't get these rights.
But Blakely did not address this specific situation where the... It did not address a situation where a defendant knew of the right to a sentencing trial at the time he was doing the waiver. You can only voluntarily and knowingly waive things that you know exist. Mr. Baldwin had no idea that this right exists and that it existed, and thus he could not have waived it. And the facts of the sentencing colloquy support that.
Why did Baldwin not know of this right when Blakely knew of that right? Blakely made a timely assertion of this right and won. Baldwin didn't.
Mr. Baldwin did not know of that right, and therefore he could not have knowingly and voluntarily waived it. In any event, there can be no dispute that Mr. Baldwin did not waive his right to proof beyond a reasonable doubt on the sentencing facts. Second, Mr. Baldwin did not waive his Booker argument by failing to raise it in his initial brief. The government spends a significant amount of time on that in its brief, but this court has rejected that argument in Henningsen and in some other cases. The defendant does not waive a Booker argument by failing to raise it in a brief filed before Blakely was decided. Third, the trial court committed plain error. All the requirements of plain error are met. First, there was an error under Booker. For the most part, the government doesn't dispute this, and its claim that the government did charge and prove position of trust beyond a reasonable doubt is not supported by the record. At most, the government cites to the record deal with a claim that Mr. Baldwin offered Mr. Piscopo a fraudulent investment. Second, the error was plain. The government does not dispute and cannot dispute that this was a clear and obvious error under Booker. Third, the error affected substantial rights. A structural error impairing the jury trial right and the reasonable doubt standard of proof always affects substantial
Excuse
rights.
Excuse me. How is your position about this reconcilable with Cotton, which, of course, rejected the claim that an Apprendi error is structural or anything like that? Cotton holds that Apprendi errors are not plain error. Why would a Blakely error be any different?
It's only the third prong of the standard that I'm talking about here, whether it affected substantial rights. And in this, and the structural error here is similar
to
the
structural... It's an argument expressly rejected in Cotton.
This is similar to the structural error that was in Johnson, the structural error that involved the jury trial.
Cotton, right? Cotton is about Apprendi. Blakely is an Apprendi derivative. If Apprendi itself is not structural error, as Cotton holds, then I don't see how its derivatives can be structural error.
We believe that under Johnson that this was a structural error and it cannot be a harmless error. But even if that were not the case, reversal would still be required because the error here clearly did affect the outcome. And for a few examples, on the role in the offense enhancement, the evidence that Mr. Reeves recruited Mr. Baldwin, that he drafted and signed the contracts governing the program, that he was the primary beneficiary of the scheme, that's all sufficient to raise reasonable doubt. On position of trust, as I discussed earlier, the record below requires a finding in Mr. Baldwin's favor on that enhancement. But even if the court disagrees with that, the evidence below clearly raises reasonable doubt. And on obstruction of justice, the government did not even respond to Mr. Baldwin's argument that an obstruction of justice enhancement based on testimony at trial can never be proper under Blakely and Booker. Fourth, there can be no doubt that Booker errors seriously affect the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of judicial proceedings. Mr. Baldwin's...
That argument was, of course, rejected in Cotton, too. Why would Blakely and Booker be different from Apprendi itself?
Blakely and Booker are different because, in this case, we have a situation...
It's not this case. I'm asking as a general matter, right? Cotton is not limited to cases in which the defendant is named Cotton. Right. Why, as a general matter, would this be different from direct Apprendi errors and the holding of Cotton?
This error is exactly like the error in Johnson. It's a structural error involving the jury trial right and the reasonable doubt standard.
Look, Apprendi itself is about the jury trial right. Do you want to talk about Cotton or not?
We think that Cotton is... We think that Cotton is that Johnson rather than Cotton is the relevant authority here. Mr. Baldwin's sentence was drastically increased based on facts that were not charged and not found by a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. The unfairness and threat to the integrity of the judicial proceedings from the impairment of Mr. Baldwin's jury and burden of proof rights is clear. Even if this court does not reverse Mr. Baldwin's conviction, it should vacate his sentence and remand this matter for resentencing.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Studden. Mr. Fox.
May it please the court. The district court committed no reversible error in convicting or sentencing the defendant. The first point that I want to address is the defendant's intent to defraud, and
Before you address any of the things raised by your adversary, I'm worried about the district court's revision of this sentence after judgment to make them partially concurrent to get to 78 months. I gather the district court made that change more than 7 days after imposing sentence, correct?
Your Honor, that obviously was not something that was briefed.
It may not be, but the Supreme Court has told us that 7-day line is jurisdictional. And we have to review jurisdictional issues, whether anybody raises them or not. And so the question I'm asking is that change effective? Right, we've got statutory maximums of 60 months on these counts, and they were made partially concurrent after the 7 days had run. And I wonder whether that isn't just an invalid act in excess of the district court's jurisdiction.
Your Honor, if I may, I'm not prepared to address that today. I'll have to look back at the record, and what I'd like to do is submit additional briefing on this point so I can go back, look at the record, and confirm what you're telling me today.
You may have 7 days to do that, Mr. Fox. And in the event that there's any challenge to the representations made by the government, Mr. Staunton, you may have 5 days to respond.
Moving on to the defendant's intent to defraud, it was clear that there was a pattern of deceit from the defendant. He pitched this scheme to Mr. Piscopo, the victim. The evidence showed that the scheme was the defendant's plan. He held himself out to be one of only a few people in the world that could do these investment schemes. He set up these shelf corporations and bank accounts that were used to facilitate the scheme. He himself, although the defendant calls it only a little bit, he reaped $90,000 personally from this scheme, and he circulated the rest of it to his friends, to people he thought might have valid investments. I think the most damning thing, though, to his claim that there was no intent to defraud, though, is what occurred after Mr. Piscopo's money was gone. Mr. Piscopo was asking for the money, wanted it back, and the defendant continued to posture, change excuses, come up with different reasons why he could not get the money to Mr. Piscopo. So it's very clear from the record that there was intent to defraud, and of course there's a heavy burden of proof there that I don't believe the defendant can meet. Moving on to Blakely, as you know, there have been a lot of cases before you trying to parse out Blakely, and right now the issues before the Supreme Court on Booker. I think this case is a little bit different, though, in that it was a bench trial. I think Blakely really holds that a jury must find elements of the offense, and what Blakely says is that the elements of the offense can change if there are certain sentencing enhancements. So what the defendant's really doing is waiving the right to have a jury.
I don't understand that. What do you mean the elements of the offense change if there are sentencing enhancements?
There's, as Justice Scalia wrote, there are relevant statutory maximums. And if you're going to go above those relevant statutory maximums, a jury's going to have to find that beyond a reasonable doubt.
That's different from the elements of the offense.
I think it.
Unless the government has decided to completely change its tune, there was an enormous fight after Apprendi about whether that affected the elements of the offense. And of course, in Cotton, the United States persuaded the Supreme Court that it did not change the elements of the offense. Has the United States done 180 now?
Your Honor, it may not be an element of the offense, but if you're waiving the right to have a jury determine the elements of the offense and you're saying the district court can make the factual findings to lead to the finding that the elements of the offense exist, it seems to be a stretch to say then that a sentencing jury should be impaneled to determine these sentencing enhancements. I think that your opinion in Brough is very similar to this case in two ways. First of all, there was
my opinion.
I'm sorry,
the court's opinion.
The Seventh Circuit's opinion in Brough. It was found that there was a jury right to a decision maker under Apprendi unless the defendant elected a bench trial. Well, that's exactly what occurred here, and I agree with your court's assessment that Apprendi created Blakely. Blakely falls under the family tree of Apprendi. There is no plain error analysis for the burden of proof standard. The burden of proof standard must come under the plain error analysis. Forfeiture cannot be met here. The defendant did not preserve the argument below. The Booker case is obviously before the Supreme Court, so there's going to be a decision on whether there was error at all in this case. But I think, more basically, this did not seriously affect the substantial rights of the defendant. It didn't seriously affect the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of the judicial proceedings. The sentencing facts here were overwhelming. The district court relied on many of the same facts in convicting the defendant as it did in sentencing the defendant. The district court found the defendant's testimony to be absurd in this case. As the same day that Blakely came out, the opinion in Shiriro came out, which said that judicial fact-finding does not seriously diminish the accuracy of the fact-finding process. Again, in Brough, that supports the position. There was a case that I was reading last night, United States v. Nance, 236 F3rd 820. This is the first time that I read this case. This is an Apprendi case.
Have you served a letter on your adversary?
Your Honor, I did not.
No, we have a circuit rule that you cannot discuss at oral argument a case that you have not notified your adversary is relevant.
Okay, Your Honor, I will not address that case then. The structural error argument that the defendant talked about, this is not something that's available to defendants in federal cases. Under Rule 52, there is no authority to make an exception to this rule. Forfeited issues have to be considered only if they affect substantial rights. Cotton, as you mentioned, holds that Apprendi errors are not structural errors, so that is fairly clear. The abuse of the position of trust enhancement, I think there are two reasons why here it is appropriate. First of all, the defendant acted as an investment broker. He pitched an investment to the victim. the victim then chose to go with the defendant as his investment broker. He held himself out to be an expert again in this field. He went to banks. He said he was going to banks and setting up these schemes. There were questions about how is this any different than a lawyer? Does the lawyer abuse his position of trust if he holds money in a trust and then takes the money out? I think that that is part of what's going on here, too, because the lawyer abuses his position in a manner that significantly facilitates the commission or the concealment of the offense. That happened here. The defendant was the only one with information about what was going on with Mr. Piscopo's money. He made sure that Mr. Piscopo could not ask questions about where that money was going. So there was he concealed the offense using his position as an investment broker, the only one who had access to the information that was important to the victim in this case. As far as the role in the offense goes, the defendant again set up these shelf corporations himself. He pitched the scheme to Mr. Piscopo. He himself was the person dealing with the bank executives, according to what he told Mr. Piscopo. He had the primary contact with the victim. I think there were only one or two instances where this Mr. Reeves person had any contact with the victim. It was mainly Mr. Piscopo and Mr. Baldwin dealing with one another. So I think the role in the offense is also clear. Obstruction of justice, the district court found that he got on the stand and not only was his testimony incredible, but it was also bordering on the absurd. That comes as close, I think, as any language can to showing that that was proved beyond a reasonable doubt.
Would you address the statute of limitations argument? Count 2 fell within the suspension of the statute, as I understand it, but count 1 was filed one day afterwards?
Correct. So the only prejudice that the defendant may have suffered is $100 in a special assessment because there was an additional count of conviction. I think that the cases show that $100 is not enough to show that it substantially affected the fairness and reputation of the judicial proceedings.
Wasn't the 60-month sentence imposed on count 1?
It was, but all your honors have discretion to, of course, remand the case if you feel appropriate. And all that would happen in that case, I believe, is that the district court would impose the sentence differently to come up with the same 78-month term. So it would just be probably more paperwork than anything else because she would be instituting the same sentence. So it's a discretionary thing for your honors to decide. I think here it's not appropriate. It won't change anything in the outcome. Okay, if there are no further questions, I just ask that this court affirm the conviction and sentence of the defendant. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fox. Mr. Staunton, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Judge. On the statute of limitations point, we would argue that the $100 assessment was not the only prejudice. There was a separate conviction, and it did affect the sentence, as you said, Judge. And in any event, the $100 special assessment is enough in terms of prejudice. In terms of the attorney and trust relationship, the hypothetical posed by Judge Easterbrook, that is a special relationship, the attorney-client relationship. We think that that's distinguishable from this relationship. In terms of position, the role in the offense, the government just recited certain facts that support their position on role of the offense. But the point here is that in order to show that the outcome will be different, we just need to show that there could have been reasonable doubt. And the facts that I recited show that there could have been reasonable doubt here. On Cotton, the court recited in Cotton that there was overwhelming evidence of fraud in that case. It also stated at one point during the opinion that errors usually must have affected substantial rights, and so that it left the opening that this rule could still apply to cover, that a structural error could still make the third prong unnecessary, the third prong on the plain error standard. And on Breaux, it's distinguishable on its facts. In that case, the defendant consented to a trial of all issues by the judge. And that case certainly had nothing to do with the reasonable doubt standard. Thank you, judges.
All right. Our thanks to all counsel. Mr. Staunton, an additional thanks on behalf of the court to you and your firm for accepting the appointment and ably representing the petitioner in this case. Case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed to the second case of the day.